You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This episode of the Comedian's Comedian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and then enter the offer code COMEDY at the checkout. A better web starts with your website.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to a wonderful comedian, a very unusual comic, and someone to whom I really relate in terms of his doubts, if not his talent. This is the brilliant Noel James.
I'm currently filming a sitcom, again, in Welsh language for the Welsh language television channel, and it's a sitcom which involves writing, it involves performing, and similar to Curb Your Enthusiasm, a lot of the performances are largely ad-libbed with me and three other performers. You may have heard of some of them, Frank Honeybone, Rodri Rees, I'm sure you've heard
yes,
of.
Yes, I
so
know.
We're all doing that, and it's going to take us up at least to the end of July. And last week we performed a gig. It was with members of the public in the audience. It was filmed, so it was actually the sitcom, but at the same time we were doing a proper gig to an audience.
Okay.
And at the end of the gig, I'm not sure if I should reveal this, but I mean it doesn't really matter because I was electrocuted by the microphone. I mean acting,
sure,
but I collapsed and the audience didn't know this was going to happen.
Okay.
Apparently there is a few comedians out there have seen photographs. I don't know where they've seen the photographs, but somebody's Twittered them or Facebooked them or something, and it looked quite serious that I added.
I see. Hence the concern.
Yes.
There. I understand.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But then, metaphorically speaking, if you look, like I said, at the last few years where I, you know, back in 2004, I think, after I did an Edinburgh show in 2000, I mean, I did an Edinburgh show in 2007, but in those interim years, I didn't do that many live comedy gigs, certainly not in England.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I've seen things, blogs by various comedians refer to me. You know, Gavin Webster, who I really like, said something about all the wordplay comedians that are around. And by the way, what happened to Noel James, who was quite a good wordplay comedian? You know, the now forgotten Noel James, I believe, was what he wrote. And so, you know, there is that. And I think in what we call show business, it's quite obvious that you have to keep, you know, it doesn't matter how well known or how successful you think you are. If you want a profile, you have to keep hustling and you have to keep working, grabbing people's attention. And perhaps I haven't done that enough.
Let's leave that to one side for now and go into, because obviously I want to talk about your writing and I want to get into the nitty gritty of how you write.
Okay.
So before we get to that, how would you for a listener who doesn't know you?
Yes.
You say a wordplay comedian. Just could you sort of? I know it's always a horrible question to be asked, but what is your? How would you describe yourself to someone in New Zealand who's never seen you before?
G'day.
I could see you thinking on that, and I thought there was no need to give an example of New Zealand there. But go on. What's your act?
An interesting point that the kiwi fruit is the only flightless fruit. That's from New Zealand. I mean, if I were doing a gig in New Zealand, I may start with that joke.
Gotcha.
It is a joke which contains wordplay, which... You know, I would say that I would like to be many things when I'm on stage, but I have to settle for a couple of things. You know, okay. The reality is that we all have to settle for what we've got and what is physically possible to bring across to the audience. I mean, inside me, I am bursting with ideas and passions and all sorts of things that I'd like to put into reality. And I once read a quote about the definition of genius, and I can't remember who wrote it, but he said, to me, the definition of genius is being able to put into the real world, into reality, the ideas you have in your mind. And that is actually much harder for some of us than others, it seems. I mean, I would love to make a film. I would love to write stuff. But as it is, I do gigs. I do live gigs. So I'm on stage and I think my stuff is intelligent. I think I project a spirit of some kind, a happy-go-lucky, likeable spirit, a man who likes to have fun with the comedy. I like to, you know, if people... I like the underdogs in life. I like Laurel and Hardy. You know, I like Monty Python. I like eccentricity. I don't really observe things. I don't really tend to go on about real life situations and relationships and things that happen to me on the train or in the post office. And I don't talk about political events and situations in the world. And yet I do refer to these things from time to time. And inside me, I'm interested in these things and I would love to have conversations about these things. But for some reason, I have a... for want of a better word, a persona. You know, some people think he does clever jokes. Some people think he does daft jokes, silly jokes. And perhaps that's the end of that description.
Okay, so you do, in a set, you will do predominantly what I would think of as one-liners. Would you? Would you agree with that?
I would partly agree with that, yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think that the jokes I do, I over time evolve them so they flow into another joke, which, for example, a series of jokes that I came up with recently meld together. So my friend's gone to Tibet to study Buddhism, and the first thing they taught him was how to levitate. They have to teach him that out there because that's the only way they can get a signal on the mobile phone. Now, Tibet, of course, is the roof of the world, so I do not intend to slate it. But they've also said he must not send photographs. He cannot email me photographs of the Himalayas, which is really annoying. He says he can't because Buddhists don't believe in attachments. That is a series of... There's three jokes.
Yes.
Plus three one-liners. The Tibet one is a one-liner, which I can imagine somebody like Steve Wright doing. You know, like it's a small world, but I wouldn't like to paint it.
Yes.
So, but you know, I fit them together, and they don't. I'm not saying they form a completely seamless passage, but I guess it's flowing short routines made up of one-liners, and sometimes just one-liners.
Are you doing now the same sorts of jokes as you were when you first started?
Yes, more or less. But when I first started, I had no idea how to write a joke officially according to any standard. I knew I could write funny things. I had an instinct. When I was in school, I was, you know, writing sketches and things for the school shows. I went to university and did physics for 3 years. I don't believe I had enough guidance in school. I don't believe, you know, I would have been happier doing French or languages or something. I did do an O-level in drama, and that's the only O-level I failed. Anyway, enough about the bitterness of school and things, because university gets even more bitter. In the final year of university, and I'm not saying this is a joke, Ren, this is absolutely true. My mother, I was 20 years old, my mother passed away when I was in the final year of university. Okay, it was an extremely, it was a very unexpected thing, it was an extremely shocking incident in my life. You know, there's nothing that ever has come close to it. And while I didn't really enjoy physics in university, I could do it, I was doing it, I was heading for a secure future, perhaps working in some, you know, the aerospace industry or whatever. And then in the final year, this happened, and it really physically affected my mind. Not only did it affect the relationship I had with my father and my brother, and that is my family, you know, it was a lot, there was a distance between us suddenly, because the underlining idea that if one of your parents is now no longer here, well, what was the point of all this university? What was the point of all this going? You know, because you do it to make them proud, don't you, to a large extent? But also just a physical shake-up of my mind, my brain. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't focus on anything. But while I'd been in university, I'd had one friend who I'd made, and he was studying English, and he was from Surrey. And, you know, for me, from South Wales, I went to Manchester University. It was an unexpected cultural change. And I didn't realise this. I wasn't very good with, you know, with people. I wasn't very sociable. I didn't realise while I was in school and while I was growing up in this part of Wales, how, you know, how shy, not shy, but how just inept I was at how to make friends and stuff like that. So gradually, I made one friend at university, and he was from a completely different background to me. He was from Surrey. He was studying English, and we had this this mutual interest in writing. We just sort of one day we clicked. I won't go into detail, but we clicked. We started writing funny poetry. Funny. Okay. We thought it was funny. We called it pie poetry, you know. And
why was it pie poetry?
By merit raised, subsequent I established, and bitter in the Cairngorms, Smithfield I muse. Let us be occupied with the low life of pitterbread. Heckle. I can't remember the rest, but that was the sort of thing we were doing. Some of it had obvious jokes in there, and some of it was just, oh, we liked it. We were being indulgent,
you know? I have to say, when you said funny poetry, I had no idea it was going to sound so poetic. Do you know what I mean? That sounds it sounds like kind of Joycean. Do you know what I mean? Or, what's his face? You know, Dylan Thomas.
There was,
actually poetic. You hear a funny poem and it's a limerick or whatever, but that's a very unusual thing to happen.
I think, I mean, he, obviously studying English, Mike knew a lot more of the references, certainly Joyce and things in there. We came up with terminology for the type of lines. For example, a clinker would be a line that we just insert suddenly. It would be a sharp contrast to the line in before it. You know, we had all sorts of terminology. And this was going on throughout the last 2 years of university. And then through him, I met drama students. And from them, I heard about the comedy circuit that was in London. This would be in the late 80s. And I'd heard about how drama students were getting equity cards from doing gigs on the comedy circuit. So then I kept that at the back of my mind. And as I say, even since school, I'd always been interested. I'd always followed lots of comedy on television. In the 70s growing up, there were so many sitcoms and so many different diverse types of comedy. And it was all pretty good quality. I mean, looking back now, maybe some of it's dated. But at the time, you think, you know, there's all these stand-up comedians on television. There's Monty Python starting up. My brother, who was 7 years older than me, tuned me on to the early Monty Python, Spike Milligan shows. Brilliant stuff, you know. So I had all that. Then something happened. When I went to university, I kind of, I'm not sure if it was something like ME or some weird thing happened to me. As I say, it was traumatic just going to university, to Manchester and leaving home. And then at the end, with my mother dying, just a personality change, just a complete change came over me. And one thing emerged from that, and that was, instead of just going on to do a safe job using my physics qualification, I would forget about it for now and I would do something that I was genuinely passionate about or genuinely interested in pursuing, which was the comedy. My brother was already living in London, and he still does, so I had somewhere I could kind of lodge or live temporarily when I got there. I got a job doing a temp job for British Telecom, and I started looking up in Time Out magazine. I knew nothing about the comedy circuit or the comedy scene, but my friend Mike and I, he helped me work on a 10 minutes. Well, when I phoned the first club, we went along to see comedy. I remember, I finished the degree, I got a 2-2, I went to America for 3 months to work on a kids' camp. Looking back, I wish I'd gone back to America, but I came back to London. My father and I he was a changed man as well, because his wife had died and he didn't have the same warmth as he used to, at least I didn't think he did, and it was all a bit funny and weird. And I went to London, looked up time. We went to see a cabaret in the Meccano Club, which I think is still going, mm-hmm. in Islington. And that was the first time I'd ever seen that type of setting for a live comedy show. And there was more cabaret at the end of the 80s. So you had comedians on, and you had people like Younger and Parker, who were a jazz music duo. They would be headlining.
Comedians would be sort of in support of a more classical cabaret act.
Often, not necessarily all the time. You might have Younger and Parker on the same bill, not necessarily headlining, but you'd have more diversity. You had a lot of good comedians, deadpan people, comedians who are no longer around anymore. Johnny Immaterial was a brilliant guitarist and songwriter, and really funny and dry. A lot of dry comedians. You had a guy called Jez Prince, who was a very deadpan dry comedian. You had Mark Thomas and Kevin Day would show up, and Adrina Durrell, Australian comedian. You had all these people, and I remember the compere was a lady called Maria Callas, not the opera singer, but she went on to do a show with Graham, what's his name?
Norton.
Yeah, she went on to do host some show, but Graham Norton's gone on to bigger things. So you had these. Maria Callas was a very interesting, subtle comedian. You had a lot of, because I went to this Islington Club more than once, the Meccano Club, to watch comedy, to see what it was like. Not that I had never been to live comedy before. When I was a kid, I saw Frankie Howard, Ken Dodd, but this was the whole cabaret alternative scene. There was a lot more politics as well, which, when the 90s came on, that the thing changed a bit more, and it was, I think, the prospect of big money was suddenly realised by various people. I don't know what happened, but it all developed. And then, so after going to see comedy in the Meccano Club, then I looked in Time Out magazine to find the telephone numbers for these clubs to see how do you go about getting a booking. And indeed, the Meccano Club, 6 months later, having been there as a spectator, I did my first open mic. And I then started to realise and learn how the system worked. So I would do 10 minutes for no money. That's when me and Mike got together. We had 3 or 4 months before the actual booking was to take place. So we formed, or I wrote 10 minutes and he contributed and he acted as a soundboard. 10 minutes of, and like I say, how do I write a joke? So my first fully formed joke, which was in my first set, I would regard as this joke, and it is this. It is, when I was born, my mother gave birth to me underwater. She didn't do this to give me a less traumatic, easier entrance into the world. It was more to do with the fact that my mother was a hammerhead shark. And there was things like that. There was references to not many references to whales. Oh, I know what you're thinking. I shag sheep, but that's not true. I took one to the restaurant once. I took one to the cinema. You know, there was just innocent remarks like that. I mean, I had no idea what audiences were like. I thought they'd be nice audiences like the Meccano Club in Islington are. But as I did more and more open mics, I realised, especially my fifth open mic was in the Tunnel Club, which was run by the legendary Malcolm Hardy. And then I was shaking for 2 weeks when I did that one because I didn't realise audiences were like that.
You were shaking for 2 weeks after doing it.
Yeah.
It was what was so traumatic about it? Was it like people heckling you? Was it?
In them days, and even now to some extent, but for many years, if I had a bad experience, if I was shaking for a, I mean, I would be affected for weeks after a bad gig. And when I say bad gig, if I had a death, when you're starting out and you die, you don't know what's happened because you've got no performance skills. You don't know enough to bring the audience around. You don't understand why they've suddenly switched off and don't like you. By the way, when I first started, it is true that I painted myself blue. I painted my face and my hands blue. And this was an idea I had. Again, it was an idea in the... I just thought it would be funny, you know, and I knew that perhaps from watching various acts in the Meccano Club that there was room for doing something outlandish. And my opening line was, I'm not colour prejudiced, but I fucking hate blue people. You know, that's what they used to say to me when I was a kid. Too long in a womb, they said, and I suppose 4 years is pushing it. And then I did some joke about womb with a view, and then I did... You know, my mother, she had a phantom pregnancy, so she wasn't bothered when she gave birth to a ghoul. There was a lot of melancholic, sad stuff in there with no actual... It wasn't structured jokes, a lot of it. It was like, I had a certain, you know, a sort of thing that was influenced by the poetry I'd been writing with Mike. Also, I'd had this idea for a story, a novel, which was probably influenced by that novel called The Tin Drum, which was made into a film. It's like an epic thing about this little boy. Is he a fully grown man who's just small? And he plays a tin drum and there's lots of weird, surreal stuff. I've always been into films and I always love those epic stories where certain things come into it that shouldn't quite be there. It's surreal imagery. You know, for example, in Game of Thrones where you have the dragons come into it. You think they shouldn't quite be there. They don't fit. So I had this idea of a boy who was born with blue skin. And he was also, while he was in the womb, he was sending out telepathic signals and the FBI picked up on it and they weren't sure if the mother was trying to assassinate somebody or they realised... That's like kind of Frank Herbert or Stephen King territory. So then when you look at the shark joke, it's almost like a short story with a twist in the tail compressed into a five-second joke.
Yes. You know,
that's So my idea of jokes initially was coming from... short stories, twist in the tail type of thing.
So this is Noel. I hope I've made the right decisions in editing this show. We talked for a good long while, but I've tried to keep the bits that were most Noel-ish and cut out a good bit of me banging on. I've got a very good friend in Melbourne called Hamish, who said to me some years ago, he said, oh, I remember, Stu, you like to give yourself a hard time, eh? And I do. That made me laugh because I do like to give myself a hard time and I don't really know why. I suspect Noel James might be the same. I think Noel gives himself a hard time. You can hear for yourself in this interview how ruminative he is. I'm sure you can hear the melancholy behind some of what he's saying. And obviously, as he describes the trauma of losing his mother and how that propelled him into comedy, there's definitely a melancholy there behind what he's saying. And I can certainly identify with some of the creative and work-related doubts that he describes. I think Noel's a genius. I always enjoy watching him, and I think he brings something genuinely unique to the stage. I'm really pleased he was so candid in this. Above all, though, I would urge you, if you're enjoying this, I would urge you to watch Noel live and experience him for yourself, because he does bring something utterly special to comedy. So, anyway, this is Noel. Before we get back to the interview, a couple of bits and bobs. Some Edinburgh recommendations now. These are basically, I sort of suddenly thought, I know a lot of you have been emailing me and saying, who should I go and see this year? Well, I say a lot of you, some of you, enough that I haven't got around to answering that I feel guilty. These are some recommendations of people I will definitely be seeing, and some of them are my friends, I should say, a full disclosure. All of them, to some extent, are my friends, but I also will definitely be going to see these shows because I think they're brilliant, and I think you should too. Joseph Morpurgo, his show last year absolutely knocked me for six. I thought he was great. I came in the last 2 minutes of a preview of his at ARG Com Fest. And I can't wait to see him. Lloyd Langford is always absolutely brilliant. Danny McLaughlin at the Tron. I saw Danny do some stuff I hope is in this show about his dad being laid off, told through the metaphor of Freddo Frogs. That bit alone, I hope that's in the show. I can't guarantee it is, obviously. But I think Danny's fantastic. And that bit absolutely blew me away. Finn Taylor, I'll definitely be going to see. I think, does this count as Finn's first year? Maybe he's out there to claw himself a nomination. He's certainly worthy of one. Rachel Paris, absolutely brilliant last year. Looking forward to seeing her again. It's Pete Dobbing's first year. Pete's a friend of the show and a long-term confidant of mine. He's responsible for a lot of the way this show works. That's come out of meetings with Pete. And he's doing his first hour, which is just... It's exactly what I expect from him, and yet none of it I expected at all. So go along. He's going to be talking about the future of food, among other things. I don't want to tell you too much about it, but he's sort of like, if you like reading Boing Boing Net, if you like far-ranging visions of the future explained to you with a lot of enthusiasm and jokes, go and see Pete Dobbing. The show is called Dobbing. That's on one of the free fringes. I forget which at the moment. I worked with Ed Gamble over the weekend at Llama Tree Festival. And thanks if you came and saw me at Llama. I had a tremendous time. Ed Gamble, though, again, did some brilliant... He was comparing, but he managed to wedge in some personal storytelling stuff that I thought was terrific. So I'll certainly be seeing Ed's show. Jo Caulfield, I worked with just a couple of weeks ago, and she's up there with another sparkling hour, I'm sure. And I'll definitely be seeing Eleanor Tiernan. I saw her at Glastonbury, but I missed her set. I can't wait to see her hour. Eleanor Tiernan, brilliant, brilliant Irish comic. So that's all of that. And I've started looking through the guide, trying to circle things. I said to myself, I'm not going to drive myself mental this year seeing five shows a day, but it's so difficult. There's so much on. Good luck to anyone heading up there. A request from listener, comic and promoter Nige Lovell. He asked, would it be possible for me to ask anyone else who's ever got a one-star review and who's going to be in Edinburgh? This is comics. I don't think you can get one-star reviews of people. Perhaps you can. Please get in touch with Nige via the Facebook page, the Comedians Comedian Facebook page. He's on there. You can definitely find him. He spells Nige, N-I-G. And if you've got a one-star review and you're going to be in Edinburgh, please give him a shout. He's doing, I think it's called The Worst Show at the Fringe or The Worst Show in Town or something. I'm going to be doing that gig. It's basically a compilation show where obviously the link is that everyone has at one point or another had a one-star review. He tells me I'm eligible because Show Me the Funny got a one-star review on IMDb off a punter. And with those kind of credentials, I'm sure it's going to be a brilliant show. It's going to be wonderful, or a car crash, or both. Certainly worth seeing. I'm looking forward to it. And now a word from today's sponsor. This episode of the Comedians Comedian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and simple to build your own professional website and online shop. I just threw in that extra and there because I think that's written amusingly. They're easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, responsive designs, and 24/7 customer support teams. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, where are they based? I'm telling you now, they're based in New York and Dublin. And that means you can create a beautifully designed website for as little as £5 a month. Only a fiver a month. And they are. I mean, they're genuinely beautiful. I wouldn't be advertising them if I hadn't checked them out. And they do look awesome. That includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, please make sure to use the offer code COMEDY to get 10% off and to show your support, in inverted commas. That means they give me some cash for the Comedian's Comedian. No credit card is required. You can start building your website today. That's all from that. Let me know how you feel about the ads. Those are the last two. We sort of booked those two in. I'd be interested to get some feedback from you as to whether I do more or whether they make you sick with rage. One person in particular is very angry about them. Everyone else has been sort of quite positive. But I'm eager to canvass your opinions. Let me know as well who you're going to go see this Fringe. You can do that by tweeting at ComComPod or emailing me info@comedianscomedian.com. Holy shit, I didn't even advertise my own show. You all know about it already. Extra Life, I'm so excited about it. I've got two previews left and I've never been more ready or excited for a festival. It's called Extra Life. It's on at 7 o'clock at the Pleasance Courtyard in the attic. Wear shorts. It's going to be baking hot, even on cold days. And I don't know if I really told you much about the show, but it's basically all about how I want to have kids, but am terrified of that. And it will also, it's very likely to complain. It's very likely to contain two of my brilliant girlfriend's impressions. She does impressions of inanimate objects, and I've been occasionally wedging them into the show, fully credited, of course. And they are, in my opinion, they're the best bits. So come along and see that 7 o'clock every night during the Fringe. And if you're not going to be there, but you know people who are going to be there, please direct them, send them my way. Also, of course, 11 o'clock on the 10th, and then the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th of August, we're doing some live comcoms. We've got already booked up Sam Simmons, Bridget Christie, we've got Josie Long, and a brilliant Phil Kay as well. They're all brilliant, of course. One more mystery guest. Oh, it's such a mystery. Why is it a mystery, Stuart? Well, it's because they're not booked yet, but they're definitely going to be great. So get in touch and come and see those. They're on at 11 o'clock at Bob and Misbehaves Bookshop on Holyrood. I'm going to say Road. Google it, you can find it. That's everything. Let's get back to Mr. Noel James.
I mean, what we're talking about here, in my mind, is we're talking about psychology. We're talking about feelings and emotions inside us. I mean, you yourself have just said that the audience sees you as one thing, but inside you feel like a lot more, you have a lot more to offer. And you only have to think about comedians you've met on the comedy circuit who are one thing off stage, presumably themselves. If you know them, even to a small extent, they talk to you, you do gigs with them, you get to know them. And then a lot of those comedians, when they go on stage, their act, for want of a better word, what they do on stage, is a completely different side. It's not nothing like what they're like off stage. And sometimes it's a nice surprise if you've never seen them before, but you've known them to talk to. And sometimes it's, in my mind, I mean, I've seen a couple of comedians where I've thought, no, it's a shame. I wish they reflected more of what they were like off stage. Now, I know, I once heard somewhere that, whether this is true or not, that Mark Thomas said that he doesn't like comedians who do, in inverted commas, an act, right? Mm. So my problem, amongst many others, is I think too much, or I think a lot about things, and I can never end up anymore with a conclusion. Because if you think about the definitions of words a lot, and then you think of what a comedian does, and what I do in comedy is, I'm messing around with words all the time. My brain is like just, it's just a series of channels, you know, like those chutes in the old postal systems where you put things
okay.
You know, that's what's going on in my brain. First of all, when I'm writing material and when I'm performing it, especially if I'm also trying to get a laugh spontaneously about ad-libbing something in the middle of a joke. And then when I'm off stage and I'm quietly contemplating comedy, and I do read about comedy, I do collect books about it, you know, I've got these things here. I mean, there's a book here, Inside Jokes, Using Humour to Reverse Engineer the Mind, by a philosopher, Daniel Dennett. Now, okay. I haven't even started this yet, okay. And I really do not look forward to reading that. Because a philosopher who's going to write about what jokes are, you know, you and I probably know more in our little thumb than Daniel Dennett or even Freud knew about comedy. Sure. You know? And then you've got this The Mirror of Laughter, which is probably a bit more accessible. You get people who try and write books, they're trying to ascertain why jokes work, you know. So I never try to go there, but then you come back to simple definitions like, what is an act? You know, what is an act? Am I doing an act when I'm on stage? Well, if that's not my real-life persona that I'm doing on stage, then it must be an act. So I think it's possible to think too much about comedy and to, rather than just get on with it. Because I think there's a group of people, and I'm fortunate, I consider myself fortunate to be, I know we have an instinct whether we're funny or not, right? And in that sense, we have an advantage over so many people who do open mics and perhaps never get any further. And we also have an advantage over many people who do, in fact, get material success in the world of comedy. And for the life of me, I do not know why, right? But there are reasons why people get success in comedy besides being funny on stage, okay? I'm sure that those reasons involve the ability to schmooze, the ability to talk to the right people, etc., or just to be presentable, you know? And he says, whilst wiping the shit from his face, right? So I am an outsider. We're all outsiders to some degree. You've said that, you know, you feel you have a lot more to offer than the audience perceives. Perception, now that's a big word in comedy, you know. In fact, I mean, I've read a lot by a guy called Colin Wilson, who's still alive. He often gets relegated as a minor writer because he writes a lot about the occult and subjects that nobody else wants to deal with. But he was one of the original angry young men in the late 50s because he wrote a book called The Outsider. And The Outsider was a critique of what he saw as people throughout history who've never quite been able to be part of the system because of certain traits that they had or things that they said that they would never be allowed or admitted into. But then you have to look at, well, what is that norm? Mm. What is that majority? Mm. What is that society? I mean, I'm not a particularly social person. And then if you read books and newspapers and watch television, it's quite intimidating because you're led to believe that as a human being, you have to be social. But then if you look at primates, and we are a primate, orangutans are solitary primates. So therefore, you think, well, why can't you be solitary? What's wrong with that? And of course, there's thousands, there's millions of people in the world who are solitary, but that's never mentioned. You know, there's a certain voice, you know, and I think someone like Bill Hicks was a very good observer and commentator on this. He said something that what you need when you watch all the channels of rubbish on television, you know, that what the public are craving for is one voice of truth. And but what that truth is doesn't it, it it's a truth which I think, you know, it's like if you're all, oh God, this is, you know, you're an outsider because you're trying to be honest to yourself, okay? And that's probably at the end of the day a thing to be more proud of than saying things there's nothing wrong with different types of comedy. You know, you can have comedians who basically will themselves say, well, I'm just talking shit and I'm getting paid for it, you know, and that's fine. But I mean, I don't know if I'm an outsider. I'm certainly indoors at the moment. I know people off stage would use the word odd about me. And I'm not saying it offends me, but what I don't like, I mean, when audiences do it, that's different. Because audiences, you are doing a job, you have to detach yourself and not take things personally. You know, but I mean, I think the word shame always strikes me as it's an interesting concept, shame, because what I've read about it is you when you have it, you don't feel it. It's like a blanket thing that can, if you have it too much in your life, it can stifle you. And I think, you know, in my upbringing, you know, with my parents and I were living in a house after my brother moved to London, the three of us. And they often would, as I grew older into my teens, I started realising that they'd have rows from time to time and they wouldn't speak, you know, for a week or so. And and I think stuff like that, you know, comes into the rest of your life. And the fact that the rest of my life has been spent.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Doing comedy, I think comedy was one of the one thing I thought I could do this, and I'm not going to feel ashamed for doing it, you know. And it's funny how people will come up to you after a gig and say, "That's the hardest job in the world. You must be so confident as a person." And it really couldn't be further from the truth, because I cannot really throw myself into any other activity in life, you know. It's not that I couldn't do certain things, like, you know, go out dancing or take up archery or become a counsellor or something. It's just that I'm scared of doing a lot of things, you know. So I'm not confident. And I think confidence is a magical quality that some people are lucky they have it nurtured in them when they're younger, and some people work out how to achieve it when they're older themselves, whether it's by using, esoteric methods like yoga, meditation, or just education and traveling. And I think there's something that people shouldn't take for granted the good qualities they have, because if it's true that a lot of these things are determined by genes, then it's like a curse then, isn't it? You can't... How the hell are you supposed to beat the genes? Do you know what I mean?
Can we just stay with this idea of fear for the moment? Because I think that's very interesting what you said, that people... And people say that a lot, I'm sure, to all comics. Oh, it's the, you're so brave. But what you just said there is, to you, it feels... Sorry, I'm not... I don't want to put words in your mouth. But it seems that what you're saying is you find real life, other things, archery, dancing, those other things you mentioned.
Yeah.
You feel those are more scary than going on stage and doing a gig. Do you think, have I got the right of the stick there?
Yeah.
What is it about those things that scares you? Because I think this is a fascinating subject, because any of us that get up there and stand in front of the gaze of potentially hundreds of people, thousands of people for some acts. Yeah.
But I don't only do gigs to gays, Stuart. I do gigs to heterosexual people as well, okay? So let's get that straight, okay? That's what I'm saying. Am I taking this into an analytical territory that is not worthy of the lightness of this conversation?
No, because there's 100 light podcasts out there, and this is a deep conversation.
Okay,
I'm interested in knowing, because I initially started doing this because I struggle tremendously with comedy, why I'm doing it, how I'm doing it. God, what if I'm doing it wrong? What if I've always been doing it wrong? I've got a lot of negative voices that I silence through doing this and asking other people. So this is exactly what I want to...
Okay,
know.
Well, I think it's possible that when you do comedy, right, when you do comedy, what does that mean? It doesn't mean you've just done a gig. It means you've committed your life to... You've committed... At least, you know, some people have said, well, I'll do a run of 5 years. And what they know that what that means is, I mean, I have no beef with so-called hobbyist comedians. I think anybody who can go on stage, if they have something, they express it and people laugh, fair play to them. However, if you decide to do comedy full time, you know that you've got to give up whatever job you have, right? And then you throw yourself into it. Okay, now that means, to me anyway, what happens and has happened is it's a state of mind. If you can deal with that state of mind, that's great. But I think when you look at all the comedians who've, since we've been doing comedy, you will notice people deal with it in various ways. Some comedians have gone a bit loopy and stopped doing it. I'm not going to name anybody, but there's certainly people I could name. Some people have hit the bottle, you know. Some people at the same time embrace fully the professionalism, the business side of it, they shine, they become Edinburgh stars, they become TV personalities all through comedy and all through using the stand-up comedy circuit as a stepping stone. If you enter into that state of mind, when I entered into it, so it's not just doing a gig, it's not just a moment, it's also writing a joke. It is a life decision.
Totally.
And yeah. And so we're in it now as we speak, right? So as you just said, likewise, I'm full of doubts. I'm always full of doubts. I'm always thinking, what the hell have I done? What have I done? Why have I committed my adult life to this? And is it too late for me to stop and try and do something different? The fact that I've, the last 2 years, because of the Welsh language television and radio, have been, in a way, the two most successful years of my whole comedy being, has sort of kept me going. But, I mean, if you... So, we're talking about the fear, right? And why we can't do other things. So the fact that I'm pursuing full-time comedy, that doesn't mean I'm doing a comedy gig every day. It means I get an awful lot of spare time. If I'm not careful, I can spend that time as a couch potato thinking too much. Even if I use that time constructively and send emails and hassle people. I mean, that is a very difficult aspect of the job, is to email people and quite politely and simply ask if you can get a gig. You try and telephone. People don't telephone so much these days. But that's a very good. So, okay, another conservative is to write jokes and then write and try and write. But then you think, you know what, this is going nowhere. I'll just have a cup of tea. I'll do blah, this, blah, blah, blah. You end up worrying. Am I wasting my time? So how am I supposed to try and pursue some other thing if I've decided I'm still taking this comedy thing seriously? The only way to pursue, first of all, arguably the only way I could pursue, let's say I wanted to enter politics, or let's say I wanted to become a teacher, which I have the qualification, I could. Really, it's difficult to, it is possible to do the two things at the same time, and especially with teaching, because you could do supply. But if I wanted another job totally, I should just cease the comedy, because the only, you have to, by ceasing the comedy, you get rid of the misery of it, the pain of it. Okay, maybe do the odd gig in a blue moon in the future, but pursue this other. It's as if you need a clean slate. You have to go back into life. You have to face. I have decided that I like the life of not having to wake up early every morning. I like the life of travelling to gigs and walking around the town in the daytime and going to the cinema before going to the gig. You know. What is that? You know, is that ambition? Does that sound like ambition? No, it doesn't. So I don't have ambition. That's the problem. And that's the thing. It's highly subjective. What your experience of it sounds in many ways similar to mine. But at the same time, you know, what is ambition? What is drive? How do you get it? If you've got it, then probably, you know, the life of many comedians are all similar. But what they've got in their minds are all completely different. Mm. And I think I haven't just pursued comedy because I like the lazy life. Far from it. I work hard in comedy over the years. I've done a lot of good things. And I think I never forget that I've got the ideas and the humour in my mind, which I like to share with people over the years. And I think at the same time, I always remember the television and the film comedians. And I think I'm a bit like a Billy Liar. You know, I fantasize that I'm up there with them and one day I will be. I can only make that happen by doing something about it. But how many times can you say to yourself, pull your finger up? Because that's the voice of your teachers when you're a kid. What's going to happen? I don't know.
Would you say, thank you, I really appreciate your honesty, I really do. I think this is, I think we have a very similar approach, the trouble with the doubts and trying to.
It's a trouble with mortality as well. You know, it's very hard to say you're mortal and this is all going to end. You just think, oh, I'm still youngish, you know, I'll carry on, this is going to happen, But the comedy world is a mindset, and I suppose, linking back to what I was saying earlier, I've never fully been able to face it without feeling a fear. And it's not just fear of going on stage. It's the fear of right, I've told myself I'm going to do comedy, therefore I must have ambition. Therefore I must aim to be on a quiz show, on a panel game show. I must aim to do auditions and be in front of people and get to know people. And there's something that's always stopped me from being fully comfortable with that.
Do you think that comedy has done to you and for you the things that you expected it would when you first started out?
No, when I first started out on the comedy circuit, as I say, I didn't know anything about the comedy circuit. I moved to London. I'd heard of Mark Thomas and Kevin Day because I'd seen them on Saturday Night Live, which was hosted by Ben Elton. And I'd went to see Ben Elton live as well in the Hammersmith Odeon in 1989. But I'd never heard of, for example, Arthur Smith, Malcolm Hardy. I'd never heard of any of these figures who were famous at the time and remained famous. They were famous on the London circuit in the late 80s, and a lot of them went on to achieve greater notoriety. So I was completely green, or, if you saw my act, completely blue. But as blue... Oh, forget that. So anyway, right. So what was the question again?
Do you think it's done for you what you thought it would over the course? You know, what were you expecting to get from it?
So when I first started doing comedy, for some reason I had this assumption that everybody involved in the comedy world would be intelligent people. That was my, you know, I was 22 years old, those are the words in my head, whatever that means, however you define that. I thought people would be, most people, and virtually everybody I met were friendly, and but then I started to mix with people in car shares and in clubs. And, you know, for example, one of my first open mics was I was booked to do 10 minutes in one of my first ever open mic spots. And the guy running the club on the night said to me, if you could keep it to 5, which of course is, you know, comedians take a lot of shit, Stuart. You know, we really do take a lot of shit, and I think I was living with an ideal image in my head of, you know, everybody who does live comedy is into the same type of comedy that I'd be into. They'd all be Python fans, or they'd all like Spike Milligan, and they'd all want to share ideas. And but I mean, I was, you know, as I said to you, I mean, I mean, I never had a girlfriend until I was, you know, 23. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I remember doing a gig, an open mic or something, in Salford in 1989, and there was a black comedian on the bill, and I remember talking to him off stage and saying, oh, what's it like being a black comedian, you know? And he was like, he said, you had to say that, didn't you? And I mean, I didn't intend anything other than a conversation. It was like, I suppose, when you come from the sticks, you know, it's like suburbia is a different kettle of fish. You know, it's a different way of living and communicating. And you know, has comedy made me happy? I think that it is. It's so many different things. You know, it's like, in my head, comedy is a series of memories of the years I spent, you know, going around trying to get gigs, trying to get on with people, and then getting back to wherever I was living, and just thinking, you know, about what it is and everything. And then comedy is a single joke. Comedy is just an idea in your mind. And comedy is going to see a film and having a good time and thinking, wow, that's brilliant, you know.
And you do feel part of it, don't you? You know, you were saying before about it being almost a vocation. It's a life commitment.
Yeah.
I certainly sort of find comfort, if you like, and inspiration in the fact that I may not be one of the Pythons or have had anything like one of their careers, but I'm sort of in the same gang, whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? By committing my life to comedy in the same way that lots of my heroes have.
Yeah.
I actually find that. Do you find the same? Do you sort of find, like you say, comedy is a moment or a moment in a film or something? For me, I find that very comforting. I feel like, oh yeah, I'm actually, I belong to this community.
Well, you're not much of an outsider, are you, Steve?
But it's a community of outsiders, necessarily.
Ah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, the Pythons are very interesting, aren't they? Because they clearly worked very hard to get where they got. And yet, they're Oxford and Cambridge boys. So it's like, okay, you know, what's all this thing about, you know, the old boy network? They utilised that. They must have done. But what they did was completely different to anything that had come before, really. I don't know. I get jealous of everything. I just think, you know, I never get a sense of achievement. I never think, you know, there's only a few times where I think comedy is a really weird concept because it involves laughter, and laughter suggests people getting on with each other, and people, it's a simple idea of cheering people up, you know. So, but when you get out there into the world of comedians, it's also, I don't know, it can be a bit vulgar sometimes, but sort of just the type of venues that you have to play, and the vision that some promoters have of what a comedy night is like, it's awful, you know, but it's only awful to you, you know, because other comedians will go there quite happily do it, and they'll still acknowledge that it's tough, and you think, well, you know, it's funny. I don't know. I feel like I'm letting you down here, Stuart.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is fascinating and very candid, and I appreciate that. I hope I'm not letting you down by pushing you into areas you weren't expecting. Let's come at it from an entirely different angle. What is the bit that you've written that you're most proud of?
The bit that I've written that I'm most proud of is... Oh, that's a very good question, and I should have put more thought into that before you arrived. Let's see now. I mean...
And you don't need to sort of tell us what it is and sort of, you know, risk putting it into scrutiny.
I'd like to. There's certainly a few jokes that I've come up with where I thought, wow, you know, I mean... I used to be in a band called One Armed Leopard. The drummer went deaf. And that joke was in my notebook for years before I used it. And then I did it. And I think that's a bloody good joke, that, you know. And yet, that is a joke some people won't get. They won't get it.
Yes, yeah, sure, absolutely. You know?
So it's like, well, you're left with this idea, well, is it a good joke? Because if some people don't get it, then it can't be a good joke, can it?
But well, then you think, well, yeah, but then
you get the references and it's a good joke. And a lot of people would argue that it's very important to have cultural references. But that is a limitation of verbal humour, you know. Universal humour, the only universal humour is physical or mime. And I respect that, you know, wholeheartedly. Brilliant, you know. But, I mean, if you're going to do comedy in a language, then you are limited by what people... understand within that language. So it's good to then diversify and within, you know, the English language express things around, from around the world, and whether it's a band from the 70s or whether it's politics or whatever. You know, that is the buzz that people get. I guess that's why topical humour is a genre in its own right, because people get a buzz off, oh, I've read the newspapers, I've seen the news, this guy's saying something, or this woman's saying something which is referring to that in an abstract way, and I'm getting it. It's some kind of, almost like, you know, there's a mental process there, you know. There's other routines which I am proud of, or jokes, or ideas which I am proud of. Let's see now, I was walking down the street. No, well, I mean, I don't know. I know that Tim Vine refers to one particular joke I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember doing the joke, and I dropped it after a year or so, thinking, yeah, it's okay, you know. And he cited that joke as an inspiration, which was really nice to hear. And the joke is, I met a man who was going bald. He was going bald! bald. And I must say, when I heard Tim Vine quoting it, he did it far better than I ever did it. And he said, when he heard that joke in the middle of my set, he thought, here was the license to be daft, or he said something like that. And I thought to myself, when I heard that, I thought, yeah, that's nice, that's nice, that's really nice. The thing about it is, it's taking... It's not. It's again. It's complete wordplay. It's the double meaning on the word going. It's going as in saying. So what's nice about if I do a joke which involves wordplay, but you do it. I try and do it logically so it works as a conversation piece. So I used to be in a band called One Armed Leopard. The drummer went deaf. You could take that as just something that happened. The drummer went deaf, so we retrained him how to play the drums with the aid of vibrations through the stage. And it was all going swimmingly well until one night there was an earthquake during the gig, and he took it as a cue for a drum solo. And I think he's still there. And that's the other problem. If you're going to do wordplay, you notice I said it went swimmingly well, but there was no joke about swimming.
Yes, okay.
So that's the problem when you do wordplay. I mean, it is...
And because the audience ends up listening to every word?
Well, that's the fear. That's the fear. Okay. And that's the curse of wordplay, is you then have to be careful about around the joke. Every other word has to be chosen carefully because it's a bit like, oh, you're going to do a joke with that. Well, what about that word there then? Come on. Another reason why I might do wordplay that I have an affinity to it is I do come from a bilingual background where my parents spoke Welsh and English, obviously. But they came, Welsh was their first language and technically mine, although as most kids around here growing up, you watch so much television, it was all in English. You think Welsh language, it's sissy, don't want to speak that. But when I got older, I took it a bit more seriously. But what I'm saying is, it no doubt does have some effect on the brain and how you look at words. But then again, if you read certain psychology books, wordplay is a symptom of schizophrenia. And as is, if you take metaphors, there are cases of autistic people who hone in straight away on metaphors. So if I hear a metaphor in conversation, while everybody else is calmly receiving that and taking it for granted as if they've heard it a million times before, it will always stand out to me. So, for example, I will get some of my jokes from listening to conversations where people have said things like, you know that buzz you get when you're picked up by a flock of bees? Sorry, I should have said swarm of bees. I get the birds and the bees mixed up sometimes. In fact, the first time I had sex, I had it with a pigeon who had a sack of pollen tied to his leg. Metaphors are a great form of a great source of humour. So you'll hear it, the Gary Delaney's and the Tim Vines. I mean, one of Tim Vine's brilliant jokes is exit signs. They're on the way out.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, I mean, they're on the way out is a sort of a metaphor, an idiom. And, it's just the whole thing about crisscrossing language. It's like you've got two levels going on, and I think it's the surprise of that effect that if you're a Freudian, you go, why are people laughing? And it's the release of tension. But in wordplay, it's the surprise. People, it's joy. It's a spirit of fun, and I think I try and build that and build that and build that, and then in the set, I will also try and bring another element, like maybe a bit of truth from inside, about certain things. I mean, I would like to be able to... I still haven't answered your question.
No, you have, absolutely.
Okay, this is one of my favourite ones from recent times, which I'm very pleased with. Say, I was going to wear a poppy this evening. A poppy as a tribute to my brother because... Well, heroin is his favourite drug, you say. But unfortunately, he nicked the poppy. My brother... He was so desperate. He once went to Heroin Addicts Anonymous and they welcomed him with open arms. So that was all in vain. It's not really funny, is it, to make fun of a heroin addict? Except it's quite funny Christmas time because what we do, we put him in the living room and he pretends to be a Christmas tree and he just stands like that, you see. But it's very realistic, you see, because he leaves his needles on the carpet, which is a brilliant touch, I think. I mean, that's a nice little series of jokes, you know, because there's a jokes from all different years in sort of doing comedy, and I'm just putting together. I think the poppy line is an interesting joke because it's a basic wordplay. It's not a wordplay, though, is it? It's poppy.
Yeah, it's poppy. Idea play, isn't it? It's like another...
Again, it's an allusion to something, an association. Poppies are not just associated with war veterans and people who died in the war, but it's also associated with heroin. You know, poppies in Afghanistan, I believe that is the plant. Yeah. Right, so the joke makes sense. And yet, that joke can piss people off. And I did a gig recently where someone came up to me and said she was actually wondering what happens if a joke goes down badly, because her friends heard the poppy joke and were immediately upset by it. I'm thinking... Why are you upset by that? I know why you're upset by it, because you think I've just said something disrespectful about war veterans. But actually, I haven't. I've just told you why I was going to wear a poppy, because I think of my brother, because he was a heroin addict. Mm. You know, of course it's a joke. This is why I hate these systems, these censors, who will stop you telling a joke because... they think you've just said something... You know, they'll stop certain types of humour because you've just said something
offensive. They'll hear a word that's like a red flag and they'll go, we can't have that.
Well, you can't have that, but what they're doing is they're taking the other meaning of the joke, which I never mentioned, and they're saying, you can't say that. Well, I never said it. That is the wonder of comedy, of humour... is a brilliant. You can see why people have been able to attack, you know, authority by using humour, especially in times of oppression and in dictatorships like in Russia, you know, and Poland. You had these brilliant satirists, and they would probably have to write even cleverer stuff because you would not be able to even hint
at.
And so you can see why double meanings can evolve according to the environment you're in then. So anyway, the poppy joke, then you have the follow-on with the Heroin Addicts Anonymous, and that was all in vain, and, you know, and, so I was very pleased with that. And also, I did a gig, I was very proud of a gig I did last year in the Glee Club. It was for a Welsh-language television series. I mean, Welsh-language television... have never taken many risks with comedy. Mm-hmm. Most of the comedians they've had over the last 20 years have been, you know, I'm not saying they're bad comedians, but they've been from, you know, the farming country community. So they do jokes, very long build-up, shaggy dog stories, which end up with an innuendo, a sexual innuendo, a lot of the time, and that's okay in its place. But, I mean, there are lots of people in Wales who learn Welsh in school but never speak it once they leave school. Mm-hmm. So... a lot of those people have no respect for Welsh language institutions because they strike them as boring. It's old-fashioned, old hat. And yet, you talk to these people and they will remember the odd pop singer or rock singer from Welsh language culture. In the same way, if you can get stand-up comedy more, you know, contemporary, it might bring people in. So this TV series was called Gwerthu Allan, which literally means... selling out, and it was put in the Glee Club, proper comedy venue, and I got to do 2 12-minute sets in Welsh. And what I felt was, first of all, I was paid well for it, probably the best fee I've ever had for any gig, whether it's live or television, and that was a nice feeling. And therefore, I felt more committed to it, to create, not just translate stuff from English, which I had done over the years. But the more gigs I got in Welsh and the more I spoke it with friends, the more I realised I could start creating stuff originally in Welsh. And it is a slightly different feeling in a different language, even though it's also wordplay. And then I created and crafted these 2 12-minute sets. And part of me felt, once I'd finished that and it came across well and it looked good on the screen, I felt that was actually the final harvest and result of, I'm not wording this very well, but after I'd crafted that, those two 12-minute sets, I felt after 20, 25 years of pursuing comedy, I felt that I'd put everything I'd learnt into that, because I'd learnt everything doing it in English, and then at the final stage, I'd switched the language, so I'd put another part of myself, which is, you know, from my heart, into it to as a cherry on the top of it. So that was a lovely creation, and it was an artistic thing, and it was, you know, I felt that a lot of the jokes, you know, were similar to the stuff I do in English, but it's like when you do it in yeah, it was just an identity thing that came through with it, you know, which is funny, because you try and pursue a gig in front of any audience, and you, depending on what you're trying to do on stage, I try and come across as somebody who wants to be liked. I know that sounds contrary if you look at me and you think of me as an outsider, but I actually would like to be liked. And when it works that way, you know, it goes down so much better. Other times the audience perceive you as an outsider, therefore there's a clinical element to it. But if I do it in my own native language and I can do it fluently, it's this sense of like you're back in school where everybody knew your name. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, it's Noel. All right, Noel.
Yeah.
And therefore you are able to open up. There is certain truths that come out in a different way then from your heart. I suppose my goal would be to be able to duplicate that, you know, going around in Britain, doing it in English, pursuing maybe fringe festivals in Australia, maybe go to Canada and stuff, and try and get that basic connection with people, not just deliver the jokes, you know. It's really hard to put into words. I think, you know, it's really tough, you know. This thing, the longer you do comedy, the more you see there's to learn, in a sense, about it, you know. But what you've got to learn is how to be simple about it, you know.
What advice would you give, or what was some good advice you got given, or what would you give to newer acts? There's a lot of newer acts listening to this. What would be the one message that you wanted to pass on?
Well, I'd like to say never give up, but the thing is, I'd sound more credible saying that if I'd achieved megastardom. Once I've achieved megastardom, I'd say, listen, folks.
No, do you know what? If you've achieved megastardom, it's easy to say never give up.
Yeah.
It's that's a better message if you have achieved microstardom.
Right. So my message, which is slightly adjusted, is never give up, because I'm just going to kill myself. And you can carry on the good work without me. I think that's a really good question. I've been told certain things in my time. I would not go up to a comedian and offer them advice ever, unless it was mutually agreed or they asked me for the advice. I think a lot of people, upcoming new comedians, will probably get quite hurt by you know, older, more experienced comedians just freely giving their opinions.
I am guilty of that myself, and if you're listening to this and I've once done that to you in an unsolicited fashion, I'm sorry.
I would say try and be aware of people's feelings, you know. I mean, we've discussed today, even certain words can hurt feelings. Try and be aware of, you know, where you are. If you're doing a gig and you're talking about the London tube system, just look around you, you know. If you're in Inverness at the time, you know, just realise there are different people, different types of people with different cultures and groups, and not all of them deserve to be picked on. In fact, to quote Eric Sykes, the hardest comedy is the type that sends yourself up. And although it's very difficult to achieve that, it is actually a very great thing to be able to somehow send yourself up, but not belittle yourself. You know, you make yourself the butt of the humour rather than other people. It's a hard one, but a lot of, you know, a lot of comedians approach it. You know, I mean, Woody Allen for me is a great stand-up comedian. His stuff from the 60s, very well written, manages to make himself look ridiculous and yet a hero at the same time. So, you know, it's all in the writing. It's all in the delivery. The delivery is very important. Economize. Don't put wastage. Cut all the unnecessary words out. Because even if you're not a comedian who does wordplay, you're a comedian who does so-called observational routines or satirical, you know, even there, you're using words, and too many words are a distraction. Cut to the chase, you know, to the guts of the funny bit. Mm.
Thanks, Noel. So thanks to Noel. Thank you to Noel for coming on the show. I really appreciate him being on there. As I say, see him live, watch him on YouTube. He is bringing something genuinely unique and different, and he's exactly the sort of person that I want to have on this show. He's exactly the sort of creative mind I like talking to and trying to investigate and interrogate a bit. And he is exactly the kind of unsung hero of the circuit that I would like to champion, whilst also getting all your famous people on that you've seen on TV and bought their DVDs. I think he's brilliant. Thank you, Noel, for coming on the show. Thank you to Olivia Phipps for Podmin this week. This episode was co-produced by the lovely Nathan Wood. Very, very kind of him to help me out. Dan Melrose did the music. Toby Rose has been helping me out on the website front. Oh, that wasn't very good, was it? I'll leave it in. And also, recently, I've had some nice Flash animation adverts done on my site, stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, and also on comedianscomedian.com. Those were both done by my brother, Robert Goldsmith. So you can tender work to him at robert-goldsmith.com. Next week, it's John Hastings, so go and see his Edinburgh show as well. He is superb. Sorry, I'm just basically recovering from having been living in a camper van at a festival for 3 or 4 days. Brilliant though it was. I'm up to Edinburgh in a week. So John Hastings' next episode, and then after that, they might get a little bit sporadic. I'm not quite sure how we're going to do it. That's everything. I'm knackered. I'm going to go do a preview. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.